I mean, the anxiety attacks were bad. They got worse as time went on. But just, I didn't want to do anything. I just wanted to sit in my room and cry.
Welcome to the Depression Files, where we talk about everything related to mental health, from depression and other mental illnesses, to medication, to suicide awareness and prevention, to our current mental health system, and of course, to the stigma that surrounds mental illnesses. We educate those who may know little about mental illnesses while giving hope to those who may be suffering. I'm your host, Al Levin, and I want to thank you for tuning in. Let's get started.
Hello, good evening. I want to welcome Mike Schlossberg to the Depression Files tonight. Mike is a state representative in Pennsylvania and also an author. Mike, hey, I'm really excited to have you on the show tonight.
Glad to be here, Alan. Thanks a lot for having me.
Absolutely. So, you know, it was really encouraging, actually, just the way the politics roll and such these days. I looked into some of your history as a politician, and it looked like you are a very passionate advocate within the political field around mental health. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, I typically talk about it from two perspectives. First is anything you want to do as a politician, it has to reflect the will of your constituents. 1 in 5 American adults suffer from some sort of mental illness. 1 in 2 will over the course of their lives. So that's something that we need to have a better conversation around in this country. But on a second level, and I think the one that makes me a more effective advocate for it, is it's personal. I've had depression or anxiety probably all my life in some way, but diagnosed going on about 17 years or so. I see a therapist. I take medication. I will probably for all my life. And that's a conversation that I want to have because I think that by talking about it on a personal level, I can bring more attention to the issue and be a much more effective advocate for mental health, for funding mental health, and for destigmatizing the entire area.
That's awesome. That's phenomenal. I think it also brings some credibility to you. Having been there and having had that experience and talking from that perspective. So I want to ask you a bit more about your own story of depression. But before I do that, I want to let you know, I saw when I was researching you an incredibly passionate talk at what must have been the state capitol, a speech that you gave around mental health, and I think it was May, maybe not this May, not right now, but
it was 2 or 3 years ago, that one. I do remember which one you're talking about.
Yeah, that was fantastic, and it almost seemed like it was one of the first times you were speaking publicly, maybe? I'm not sure about that.
So I first, quote-unquote, came out with my own mental illness story 2 days after Robin Williams completed suicide, and I did it in response to just it's so funny in retrospect, but some person that I was Facebook friends with after Robin Williams' death posted something to the effect of, so sad Robin Williams completely killed himself, you know, shame he didn't have enough faith in God. And it was just the stupidest, most ignorant statement, and I was infuriated. And I was so pissed off about it that I wrote an op-ed detailing my own struggles. Now, this was in August 2014. That speech was given in May of 2015, and while I had been, quote unquote, out with it, it was the first time I really discussed it in Harrisburg and in front of my colleagues. And now the speech you're talking about in particular, and anybody who wants it, you can find it by just searching Mike Schlossberg Mental Health. That one was given on the floor. We were in session that day. We pass resolutions all the time, and I have an annual resolution declaring May to be Mental Health Awareness Month. And I, you know, those resolutions can get a little boring, and I wanted to try to get some people's attention, and I did that day. And that speech was a memorable experience and a nerve-wracking one, but a very memorable one.
Oh, it was fantastic. I know a lot of times, I speak publicly as well, and I think people, you know, say, oh, what courage you had and stuff. Well, I really felt watching yours like it was really courageous. I mean, just the setting and stuff, right, at the Capitol. And
yeah, that's no matter who you are or what you're speaking about, that setting is terrifying.
Oh, my God, I can't imagine.
I don't think people realize because we don't do a good enough job, but politicians, I promise, we're all really normal. Like, I'm sitting here right now I have a 7 and a 5-year-old. We just got them to bed. My wife is staring at me, wondering when I'm actually going to be done working for the day. I'm exhausted, and it's been a nice day and a fun day, but we're normal human beings. And so to do things like that is still tough, no matter who you are and how long you've done this.
Yeah, that was incredible. So you said you were diagnosed at age 18? Is that right?
I was 18 when I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder and generalized anxiety disorder. Yep.
And you think you had it for much longer than
I'm since age 18. Sure I did. And I laugh about it. I became a psych major in part in college because I wanted to understand the workings of my own head. One of the things that I really learned was that a lot of mental illnesses are always there, kind of running in the background, but really onset in college. 75% of people who have some sort of mental illness will have it onset by age 24, and a quarter of those people have it onset between 18 and 24. So, and that was definitely me. I mean, no doubt about it.
And what describe some things that make you believe at a much younger age than 18 you had depression and anxiety?
And this might sound silly, but I was always a really sensitive kid. I would cry at the drop of a hat. I had a lot of separation anxiety from my parents. I remember thinking that what I experienced as a kid was not necessarily something that other kids went through. And the reaction I got from talking with others about what I was experiencing at the time made me further believe that. And then I think just I got to college, it was a new environment, new stressful environment, and it all really just exploded.
As a younger person, were you able to share some of those concerns with your parents or anybody at school?
Yes, definitely. More my parents. I mean, I'm lucky I had really supportive parents. And that's, as I talk about this stuff, I always have to acknowledge how fortunate I am that I had great parents, that I had great healthcare and continue to do so. And in talking, I thought it was normal enough that I didn't need to seek out treatment for it. And it wasn't that, I mean, you know, I got upset, but I was still able to live my life. And then again, it wasn't until I got to college that it really started impeding my functioning. It wasn't until I got to college that I started to actually think maybe life isn't worth living. Maybe I should just kill myself. And that's when it changed for me. That way, and it was particularly the suicidal ideation. That was really the marker for me when I was like, all right, this isn't normal now. And this isn't something I can handle on my own. And with, you know, my friends at the time and my parents, I was able to get myself I went to Muhlenberg College in Pennsylvania, in Allentown, which is where I still live. And that's where I was able to get myself into the counseling center there and get the help that I needed.
What was it like for you prior to the suicidal ideation? I mean, was this depression kind of creeping up on you? Did you have other symptoms that were taking shape that you were noticing?
In college, it was at this time in my life, it was first semester senior year, freshman year. It was, I mean, the anxiety attacks were bad. They got worse as time went on, but just I didn't want to do anything. I just wanted to sit in my room and cry. I mean, schoolwork, I was able to, when I experienced similar but less intense feelings in high school, I was able to deal with them with sublimation. I did every club and I went nuts in school. And I just spent so much time working that I kind of became really type A personality, which I think I still am. And that can be a good thing, but not if you ignore what's really going on. When I got to college, I didn't know what else to do with myself. I had a difficult time adjusting. I had a girlfriend at home that we broke up when I got to school. And then I was so miserable with that. And I became sort of, the girl kind of became a psychological crutch and I couldn't break away from her. And I don't mean that in a bad way at her. This is where I was. I needed that crutch. And it became that level of a problem. And then I wasn't busy enough. So I had too much time to think about how miserable I was. And it all sort of morphed into the depression that I went through.
Yeah, it sounds like isolation was a big piece of it, which is, it is so devastating. And that those are the times where you say, like you said, you sit around and you ruminate, right?
Yep.
And you can't get your mind off of it. And the thoughts keep coming into your head.
Yep.
So you were staying at home? Were you doing your studies?
I was not at home at the time, which was part of the problem too, or part of the challenge, I guess I should say. I was away for the first time in my life.
Right.
And that
right.
was a huge problem. No, my grades were still pretty good, actually. I remember dropping a class because I thought like most kids, I thought I was going to be, or like many kids, I guess, I thought I was going to be pre-med and then realized that was a terrible idea. So I remember dropping a class, but that didn't help because then I had even more time on my hands, and too much time to think when you're depressed is a huge, huge problem and
right.
a huge challenge. And that's something I really realized.
So you started isolating. Mm-hmm. Did you have other symptoms? Were you still getting out of bed and getting out of your place and getting to classes?
I was. And I remember my dad saying to me, I had never exercised, but I remember my dad saying to me, I had Tuesdays and Thursdays. I had no reason to get out of bed before 3 o'clock, my one class. And I remember my dad saying, set your alarm, get out of bed and go for a run. And he was right. That was good advice. And I started doing that, and it actually was helpful because it gave me something to do. It gave me somewhere to be. And I have a blog that I run, and I wrote a blog entry partially inspired by this experience. You just have to do something. It doesn't have to be productive. You just have to get out of bed and try to force yourself into some sort of action, or you're just going to find yourself wallowing.
Right. So the exercise certainly helped you. Were there other things
yep.
That you were trying to do before? And when was it that you eventually did seek a therapist? I know you said you started to have suicidal ideations.
I was in the counseling program there probably like within the first few weeks of me enrolling in school. I didn't go on medication until around that time because the depression was getting worse, the anxiety was getting worse. And I remember the counselor saying to me, look, you know, I think we're trying to come to grips with this, but I think you need some drugs to get yourself into a better place. And that's what I chose to do. And that was a decision that I think contributed bluntly to saving my life. That's the most miserable I've ever been, was probably first semester freshman year. And it wasn't until I started getting on medication and trying to deal with some of these issues, and then finally adjusting to college, that I got where I needed to be.
Right, right. And were you seeing that counselor or a therapist along with taking the medications?
Yep. Saw the counselor once a week, eventually once every 2 weeks. I remember that being such a victory. And took them. I started on Zoloft. I don't remember the dosage, but I was on the low dosage of Zoloft, and then moved around a couple of times. But I've taken medication every single day in my life, basically, since I was 18.
Right. And it sounds like you've changed them up at times.
Yeah, a couple. I remember it, thinking that I only once actually, you know, no, I shouldn't. No, twice. I was on Zoloft. I tried another drug. That one, maybe it was Selexer for like a week, and that made everything terrible. And then I went to Lexapro. That worked, and that's what I've been on some dosage or other since that time.
Right. So how long would you say you were kind of down and out? And with the suicidal ideation, there was no kind of hospitalization or anything. It was
No. I thought maybe it's time to end my life. I do remember thinking that.
Yeah.
And it's something that it's never been as severe as it was. Like, it hit the planning stages, I would say. It was like, okay, well, I'll just get a bunch of pills and overdose. But that's about the extent. I never attempted or anything like that. But that's as close as I came in my life to thinking, all right, this is enough.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I also recognized, even as miserable as I was, all right, this isn't good. I need to do something worse. You know, that's one of the only times I've ever made an emergency appointment to my counselor at the time. And
yeah.
That is the worst it's ever been.
Well, that's fantastic too, though, being only 18 and taking that step, knowing like, hey, this is getting a bit dangerous and I do
yeah.
need an emergency appointment and I need to come
yeah.
in now.
Yes. But again, I always consider, that's one of the many reasons I always consider myself very lucky, because I was able to do that.
Right.
I had the healthcare, I had the resources, and I was able to take care of myself. And that's why it's so important to me as a politician, and certainly as an author as well, to try to help other people realize that there are, you know, it's not always going to be perfect, but there's going to be resources out there that can help save somebody's life. And it's really important that people realize that what they're going through can be treated and that they're not alone.
Absolutely. So how quickly were you kind of back on track with school? I mean, was it the first semester? Was that it? And then you were doing okay?
First semester, beginning of the second. It wasn't until like midway through the second that I kind of hit my rhythm.
Okay.
And from there, I was all right. Now, obviously, that's not to say that everything went away and there's nothing but sunshine and rainbows. I mean, I've hit really rough periods in my life since then. Probably never as bad as that was. But, and you know, it was one of those rough periods that made me go, I really should try writing again. And that's partially the inspiration for the book. But it is always one of the things I've come to grips to as an adult, and really more so recently than I ever have before, is that given how severe my depression has been at points, given how persistent it's been, I don't know if I'm ever going to really be okay. But recovery isn't an end state. It's a place that you try to get to. And it's more about the journey than the destination. And I will always be trying to move towards recovery. Eventually, hopefully, I will get there. But I also know that I'll be living with this probably for most of my life. And I don't want to say I'm okay with that, but I will deal with it.
Right, right. So it's interesting. You make it sound a bit like recovery is the journey, but there is this point of recovery, it almost sounded like, that you are trying to attain. And I'm wondering how you'll know when you're there. Like, if you have days that are good now, weeks that are good, what will be the telltale saying I'm there?
That's a great question. And I don't know. That's a really good question. I've never thought of it that way. I don't know if I will ever know what recovery looks like, because there have been periods, there have been days and weeks and months in my life where I've been relatively okay. And then it snaps back and you go, oh, here we go again. I remember this terrible place. That's kind of what makes me think I'll never really be there, because no matter how long I felt okay at different points in my life, I've never been there completely.
Right.
I wish I knew the answer to that, because I wonder if I recognized what feeling okay actually looked like.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point too.
It gets a little philosophical. You go, okay, what level of upset, what level of misery should I expect to deal with in my life? And I, again, having had this for most of my life, I don't know the answer.
Right, right. In my mind, I'm thinking like, you know, between your bouts of rough times and then you go through a good patch, and hopefully your good patches are longer, your dark patches get shorter, and eventually you're done with them. But I mean, it seems like you know quite a bit about how to maintain your positive mental health and are working at it. Mm-hmm. So
I hope. It's funny, because sometimes I think, all right, I've been on this trip before, and then there's other times I go, what am I doing? Why is everything so hard and terrible? I don't know if you ever really get used to it. And it's amazing the way logically you go, okay, this is just, you know, I'm only feeling this way right now. There's nothing actually wrong. Everything is completely fine. Don't stress about it. And then other times you go, oh God, it doesn't matter. It feels like something's wrong, and how I feel is the only thing that really matters.
Right, right.
No matter what you think.
Yeah. So you still try to do the running?
No, I exercise, not running. That I am not a very good runner, but I do exercise on a regular basis, actually. And that has been such a godsend. I mean, I really underestimated when I was younger how important keeping in shape was. There's a running gag, as we talk, go from college to talking about being a state rep. There's a running gag in Harrisburg, the state capital in Pennsylvania, that when new members first get to Harrisburg, they gain the freshman 15, just like in college. Right. Because you are surrounded by food and late nights and alcohol everywhere. And thankfully, I don't really drink, so that takes that much out of the equation. But freshman members who first get there will often gain a ton of weight. And I realized before I got to Harrisburg that if I didn't get my weight under control, they were going to have to start rolling me around. So I made a conscious effort to lose weight. I was able to lose like 35 pounds. I've kept them off so far, which again, that has been such a godsend.
Ah, that's phenomenal.
It's the only thing that keeps me sane sometimes is going to the gym. And there are days where I am depressed, I'm miserable, and I think I've got to make myself get up and get out. And that's very helpful.
Do you have other outlets and other ways for maintaining a positive mental health?
There's the obvious ones. I'm very lucky. I'm married. I have a wife who loves me, who I love. I have a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old. Being depressed with little kids is challenging because they don't understand, but they can also be really helpful if, you know, I'm down and they start poking me, you know, dad, do something, dad, I, you know, pick one up and throw them into the other and they start laughing and suddenly the world isn't quite as bad.
Right.
The family is the obvious stuff. I will say, from a recreational perspective, I'm a huge video game fan. I'm like hardcore nerd when it comes to video games. That video games are actually good for depression. There's legitimate studies that have shown that. And as is apparent, I think through this interview, I write, and especially writing the book that I did helped me better get a grasp of my own feelings, and writing what I felt and putting my own emotions into another character's heart, so to speak.
Right.
That really helped me come to grips with what I've experienced a little bit more. And it's funny, you know, you write other characters talking to the depressed character in the book and you go, well, who are they talking to, the character or you? And that gets kind of interesting.
Right. That's really interesting. Hey, before we get to the book, I want to ask, so are you a gamer, like an Xbox type of thing and on the TV type of deal?
I'm more Xbox than computers. I do like computer games. Right now I've been replaying Skyrim for the 3 millionth time. And I think most Skyrim fans out there can appreciate that sentiment.
I think it was probably the day my first of four kids was born that I had to get rid of my Xbox.
That sounds tragic.
It was awful. I don't know how you have done it. It was the Xbox had to go, and also when my first kid, and luckily I don't hold this against her, she's great. I also had to get rid of my motorcycle.
That I can understand a little bit more, because it's not like you can slap a car seat onto one of those.
That's true. That would be challenging.
But and it's funny. Now, my son is 7 now. My daughter doesn't really like video games, the 5-year-old. My son does. My son's name is Oren. My daughter's name is Ayla. And if you are a video game fan with similar taste to me, you will know where those names come from.
Well, tell us.
Oren is one of the main characters in Final Fantasy X.
Okay.
Ayla is a character in Chrono Trigger, which is an old school role-playing game. Right? It was on the Super Nintendo.
So now, like, I'm wondering is this the first time that you've shared this, or is this something that your constituents have already known about before they voted?
They accept me for who I am.
All right.
At least I hope they do. Whew. They're about to hear this and go, what the heck's the matter with this guy?
He named his kids after who?
After video game. Well, my friends tease me all the time. Oh, how's Super Mario and Princess Peach Schlossberg doing? Oh, they're great, stomping on Goombas.
That is funny. So I definitely want to hear, I know you have a new book that I'd love to talk about, but what really struck me also was that it's not your first book, and you had a book published called Tweets and Consequences, and it's like you were before your time. I mean,
well,
if you wrote that
funny
book now, oh.
But the thing about it was all of my conclusions were dead wrong. The book that I wrote, Tweets and Consequences, 60 Career-Ending Mistakes by Politicians on Social Media and How to Avert a Career-Ending Disaster. The deep irony, of course, being everything I said not to do in the book the President of the United States does on a daily basis. Just without fail. So everything I said was wrong. Ignore it. Don't read the book. It's clearly completely useless. I'm not as smart as I wish I was.
Yeah, there are not many consequences that he's faced.
He's become the president, which is just great. And just in case you can't tell, I'm a pretty liberal Democrat.
But you went through 60 different real life scenarios of people, of elected officials who had tweeted out and therefore, was it only Twitter?
No, it was social media in general. Some of it was blog comments. A lot of it was Facebook. A lot of it was Twitter. Twitter in particular, because Twitter is so quick that it sometimes can short circuit the brain judgment centers.
Right.
That was one of the things that I found, and it was more usually like everybody. nobody is immune from making a stupid mistake on social media, and that obviously includes politicians. Twitter is apt for that because you can send things off so quickly that you don't necessarily stop and go, wait. Yeah. Is this going to be any good for my career?
Right. That's a really good point. I know I'm a public school educator, and I do the Twitter account for our school. So a lot of times, if I'm going to do something a little bit political, I have to check myself and be like, yeah, I better not say that because I'm representing the school right now.
My wife is a high or a middle school English teacher as well. I feel your pain.
Yeah, that I really have to watch out once in a while.
Yep.
So your new mm-hmm. book now is not yet published, correct? It's not yet
available? It comes out from the time we're doing this. It's a week from tomorrow, basically. So June 5th, it becomes available. Yeah.
Okay, June 5th. So by the time I get this published, it might be out there, but that's exciting. That's really exciting. And the title is Redemption, correct?
Yep.
So tell us about Redemption.
So and to tell the, especially with this one, let me explain kind of how it came to be. It was in 2015. I was kind of having a hard time at work. We were in the middle of a really stressful period in the state budget. My wife was having a very difficult time at work. She was at a new school. It was challenging, and we were both kind of stressed. And I was in a very, very miserable period at the time. And I remember talking with my wife about it and saying, you know what, I should really try writing again. Now, at this point, the nonfiction book, Tweets and Consequences, was about to come out, and it was a great book to write. It was a really fun experience, but I wanted to write fiction, and I had gone public at this point. I wanted to write something about mental health. And I remember this kind of goofy idea I'd had, fragment of an idea 20 years before, literally as a teenager when I tried writing and when it was very helpful to me. Even then, of kids get stuck on a spaceship for some reason. And I remember being like, oh, that's kind of an interesting idea. Let me circle back on this and try to flesh it out a little bit more. And I came to so the plot of the book is basically 20 teenagers wind up on a spaceship. And they're not sure why, they're not sure how. And as the plot unfolds, it becomes apparent that they have been placed on this spaceship by a futuristic government, and their job is to try to save the world from this deadly disease that is wracking humanity and threatening to destroy the planet. Now, that's relatively standard fare, kind of sci-fi dystopia stuff. Where I went in a different direction was I made the main character have depression and anxiety problems. And I sort of imagined the main character a little bit as a different version of myself. I was lucky. I was able to succeed in school. I was able to deal with these problems and live with them. And I had my main character be somebody who hadn't figured out how to do that yet, who had dropped out of school, who didn't have any of the benefits that I was fortunate enough to have. So there's this plot that they have to deal with, relationships they have to build, bad guys they have to kill, and they have to try to save the planet. But it's all done through the spectrum of mental illness. And I did this to try to show, at least in part, that somebody with mental illness can still do great things, even if they haven't figured out all the answers yet. And it kind of folds into my overall mission of trying to show or trying to give people with depression and anxiety hope and try to show them that if they deal with their issues, they can do anything, including maybe save the world.
Wow, that is cool. Very inspirational.
I hope so.
Can you give just an example or two about how the main character is dealing with depression or how depression shows up in his life?
Yeah, I have the main character have anxiety attacks, like in the middle of flying a spaceship. And that's – I think that's dealt with in some – I mean, certainly there's no shortage of young adult books that deal with mental illness and have dealt with it extensively in their writings. And I've done what I've done. As I mentioned before, I have a blog, and I've actually done some interviews lately with other young adult authors who've dealt with mental illness, and it's been really fascinating and illuminating for me. One of the things I've been surprised by is how rarely mental illness is dealt with directly in sci-fi. And that's interesting to me because this was the first time I really ever wrote sci-fi. Depending on how you write it, can be a great way of highlighting real world issues, and a more interesting and fascinating way if you approach it from a different angle, which I certainly try to do in this book. So it really surprised me that there wasn't more. I couldn't find There was only one other book I've been able to find so far that dealt direct, that was a direct connection between sci-fi and mental illness. And I was really surprised by this. And I wanted to kind of try to merge the two genres.
Oh, I think it's really cool. Are you actually marketing the book too in that way?
Yes. And that's been a weird challenge too, because on one hand, I want people with mental illness to recognize that this book is certainly written in part for them. Like, this can be their story and their anthem, but you don't have to have mental illness, I hope, I think, to read this book and appreciate it. There's been no shortage of the young adult books that are obviously action adventure, space, dystopian-esque sort of things. And I want it to be available to anybody. And it's trying to straddle that line is difficult. I find it easier to talk about the mental health aspect of the book because that's who I am. But that's not to say that this book can't be useful for anybody to read it, and hopefully it can give them a little bit more insight into the world of mental illness. I will add, though, I don't think there's many, if any, teenagers who don't know somebody who isn't mentally ill. As I said, you know, and as I suspect many of your readers know from personal experience, it's 1 in 5 Americans. 1 in 5 Americans have a mental illness. 1 in 2 will over the course of their life. So I think this book can be useful for anybody because hopefully it will give them a better idea of how mental illness operates. I think – I imagine I wrote the book with credibility, and I hope it's authentic to people with mental illness. And I hope it rings true and can give people a better idea of how mental illness works and how it can be overcome.
That sounds very, very interesting.
I hope so.
And I'm guessing when you describe an anxiety attack for the main character, are you basing that off of some of your own personal experience?
Yes. And also, I didn't want to make the main character me too much. I mean, certainly his experiences are informed by mine, but no doubt about it. You know, for me, everybody who has anxiety attacks has different symptoms. For me, it was always my stomach would go. That was like automatically, oh, I'm having an anxiety attack. There goes my stomach. Where's the nearest bathroom right now? Run. And so that, you know, that's in the book to some extent. But I also made sure to fold in symptoms that I didn't experience. It feels like I'm having a heart attack. It feels like the whole world is spinning around me. I wanted to make sure that the character was more than just my voice.
And is part of the goal to have the reader actually be able to almost experience that? Like,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I don't want to give anybody an anxiety attack, right, but I want people to understand what it's like to have one.
Yeah.
And to try to get a better idea that the timing can suck. The symptoms can be absolutely debilitating. Depending on how severe it is, you're going to wake up feeling like you've got a hangover in the morning. I want people to know what it feels like. So if they don't, if they're lucky enough to not know what it feels like on their own, they get a better idea of they can have a little bit more sympathy for people who do. They can have a better understanding of what it's like for somebody who does.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit about the process? So I know you said you came back to an idea that you had many years back.
Yeah.
And then just tell us what an author goes through, what you went through. Do you just pull out a notebook then and you start crafting it from day one, from the beginning to the end? Or are you building in different pieces and piecing them together? How does that work?
Everybody's got a different idea on that one. And it's funny that, this book comes out in about a week. I've written the second book. It hasn't been edited by my publisher yet. I'm in the middle of the third one now. Everybody, again, kind of has a different experience. When I first came up with the idea, I just grabbed a notebook and then an idea would hit me and I'd write something down. And then I remember one day having a few hours of downtime, I started plotting out the main characters. And then I really went through point by point with the plot. I wound up coming to wish I'd better prepared for it before I started writing. I had a vague outline, but not enough. And that left there being moments where the plot would walk one way and I would go, wait, 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 hang on, come back. And so then it made editing more difficult. My second and my third book, I've got a much stronger outline and I have a much better idea of where I'm going with it. And that has made the writing process a lot easier. But again, I think everybody's kind of got their own ideas of what works. You know, what works for me isn't going to work for anybody else. But the writing process is different for everybody.
When did you figure out that this was going to be a trilogy? I mean, did you, from day one, were you thinking, this is...
I think day one.
Really?
Because okay. I didn't think I could get the whole character arc in one book. Trilogies are pretty common these days. I think it's something that people have come to expect in long stories. And I just didn't think I could do the character justice and have – I don't want to say complete his journey because – and again, I'll refer to my own experience. You don't complete a journey with mental illness necessarily. You might be on that journey all your life. And I wanted that to come through in the book. And I just didn't think that I could really get that point home in just one book.
And do you have estimated dates for when these other two, when you're hoping to get them published?
I got to hope anybody buys number one. So no, not yet. I'm lucky. I got a publisher and that's, you know, people do self-publish. I didn't feel like I could do that well. So if I didn't get a publisher, I figured that would probably be the end of it. But I was lucky. I had a publisher, Elijah Press, their name. It's a small independent outfit, which, you know, for a first time author like me is pretty common, but they've been wonderful and supportive and really, really helpful. I'm really, really lucky. But so we're just going through number one now. If it sells, then hopefully we'll go on to book two.
Can you tell us briefly what that's like working with a publisher and finding a publisher? I know I've heard stories of people getting rejection after rejection after rejection. And
oh, God, yes. Oh, I got – well, and there's – again, I think the process is different for everybody. When I went through my nonfiction book, it was pretty similar to my fiction book. First, if you're going to get – in one of the big five or the big six, like major publishing houses, you need a literary agent. So there's a database on writersmarket.com. You can send query letters and you send hundreds of letters. And I sent hundreds of letters to hundreds of literary agents. And the competition is insane. I got rejected by every single one. I wasn't really surprised by that. Then you can start hitting up smaller publishing houses directly. Now, the good news with e-marketing and with Amazon is that it's kind of flattened the publishing world. And theoretically, I've got the same access to authors to some extent as someone like a John Grisham. Now, not really, but there's independent books do become bestsellers.
Right.
So with that, you can go to a small press, and if you hit the right notes, you can really get somewhere. So then you start hitting up the small presses. With my nonfiction book, I got really lucky and I wound up actually with two publishing companies that said, hey, we want to publish this. For this one, I just got the one and I basically stopped sending other submissions. Maybe I would have gotten more. I have no idea, but I got the one. I liked what they did and I went for it.
Nice. I didn't know that you could even have multiple publishers.
Well, you can you can have only one publisher, but you can get multiple offers. And that's what
Gotcha. Okay. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
It sounds incredibly exciting. Anything else that you want to say about the book, and also make sure you let the listeners know where they can get their hands on it.
Absolutely. Well, the book is Redemption. It is part one of the Spades trilogy. It's by me, Mike Schlossberg. You can go to my website, which is MikeSchlossbergAuthor.com, or of course you can just go directly to Amazon and type in Redemption, Mike Schlossberg, or Redemption Spades trilogy, and you can find it there. I sort of view the book in a similar, not identical, but in a similar way to I view my position as a state representative. My job is to help people, and you try to help people through whatever means you can. I try to help people. My real job, my full-time job as state representative, by passing laws and creating programs and initiatives that can improve their lives. I wrote this book to try to help people recognize what depression is, that they can get help, and that they can live good, healthy, wonderful lives, no matter what they suffer from, if they treat it correctly. That was the purpose of the book, at least on a deep emotional level. But really, I think it's an entertaining ride, and I hope other people will agree. And it was a great experience for me to write, and I hope that people have the same experience reading it.
And like you mentioned, it comes out, it's available June 5th.
June 5th. Yep. You can pre-order it now on Kindle if you're hearing this beforehand. If not, if it's available June 5th in print or Kindle, and I think the other standard forms as well, though that one you got to go to my website to get.
Okay, awesome. And in addition to that, I know just a little shout out for your website. You also have a blog on there as well, correct? And some other information.
Yep, MikeSchlossbergAuthor.com/blog, yeah.
and a couple of links that didn't work, I think, to get to your legislative page.
Oh, no. You can go to pahouse.com/Schlossberg. That's how you.
Okay.
Yeah, that's how you get there.
Okay, awesome. I'm sure that would be a pretty easy Google search as well.
Yeah, if you Google my name, you will find no shortage of information. It's an occupational hazard. You'll probably find some people who don't like me too, but what are you going to do?
That is awesome. So this is – I almost feel like this is an unfair question because you're already doing so much through your position as a legislator. But are there other avenues and other venues that you're advocating around mental health?
I mean, I speak on it all the time as part of the job. It's always something that, especially when I speak with kids, I always make a point of saying, you know, this is who I am, and I want you all to know that if this is who you are, it's okay. This can be good for you as well, I promise. Speaking on it and writing about it has been the most effective things. I imagine that it's something that I will continue doing for the rest of my life. I would certainly hope so. I like speaking. It's, again, occupational hazard, but it's a fun part of my job. So I hope I, no matter where my career takes me, it's something that I want to keep doing.
Yeah. Well, you're, like I said, watching that, the speech, that was phenomenal. So you're clearly very skillful at it as well.
Thanks.
What about, I'm pretty sure I read that you also had received an award from the American Federation of Suicide Prevention, AFSP.
Yeah, I because of speaking, I've been lucky enough to get some awards, but that's the one I'm actually most proud of. That was because that was a big one, and that was actually a national one. I was one of their advocacy allies. I got this was 2 years ago. They named me one of their top legislative allies in the country. Actually, this is the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and this. I haven't had as much legislative success as I wish I had. That's something that hopefully will actually start changing next week. But by speaking about it, I've been lucky enough, I know, to change some lives, and that's why I was honored to get that award.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Anything in particular that you can share with us along the lines of legislation that you're working towards right now with mental health?
So there's two things. Well, two broad things. First, like I said, I'm a Democratic state representative in Pennsylvania. Republicans have a majority in the House and the Senate, which means it's harder to pass legislation. But if you can find good partners, you can still get it done. I'm working with a Republican named Tara Tuhill. She and I wrote a bill. And she's the prime sponsor. I'm the second sponsor on it, which would make it so that any mother in the state's early intervention program, which is basically a program for poor or at-risk mothers, new mothers, can get screened for postpartum depression and then treated for it. So we want to make it easier basically for poor women to be treated for postpartum, which can have devastating. Oh, yeah. Postpartum is deadly and can be deadly and can have dramatically devastating impacts on not only the mother, but the child and the rest of the family.
Absolutely.
So that's number one. That legislation may move out of the House and over to the Senate next week. Please, please. So that would be such a huge win. That's part one. Part two is I've got three pieces of legislation dealing specifically with suicide prevention efforts. Trying to set up a mentoring program and a specific suicide hotline for first responders, police, fire, EMS, coroners, office employees. They face – I can't fathom the stresses on their job. And unfortunately, it does make them more likely to suffer from mental illness, to complete suicide. So we want to develop specific programs designed – to fit their needs. That's number one. Working through some of the kinks of it now to come up with a program that would require every college develop and then communicate a suicide prevention and mental health awareness plan to anybody in their school. And I'm also working on amending we deal with random issues all the time. There's a bill in front of the House Transportation Committee. It hasn't come up yet, but that would require PennDOT, the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, to erect fences if there was a risk of falling debris. I want to amend that bill so that they would have to erect fences if a location was a suicide hotspot. Unfortunately, we had a terrible example of it in Allentown. We had the 8th Street Bridge where we lost about half a dozen people a year or so to suicide. When they reconstructed that bridge, they put up suicide prevention fencing. Nobody's completed suicide from it since. We know that if we can reduce means availability, we can save lives. given that suicide is so often an impulsive decision. And so if we can make it harder for somebody to attempt to complete suicide, we might be able to get them into treatment to save their life. So that's, in a nutshell, that's my legislative priorities for mental health right now.
Wow, those are all fantastic.
Yeah, okay.
I couldn't agree with you more about the first responders and the trauma they see and go through. I hear horror stories. You know, I know a buddy who's a fireman and recently had a colleague, one of the other firemen, take his own life. And then I ask about, you know, what kind of support do they get? Very little. You know, they can have a very traumatic situation and they get very little support.
Yeah.
And I'm actually,
we need to do better.
Yeah, I'm actually, I've been trying to target some first responders, firemen, and such, as well as, vets from the military, for this podcast as well, just to reach out and expand, the diversity of the folks on the show. But I do think that's huge. And I'm actually, as an educator, really pushing for a better system of support for at least the urban educators, who I think we are dealing with kids who are going in and out of complex trauma on a daily basis. And there's plenty of secondary trauma that we are experiencing. And I think that educators have very highly stressful jobs currently, where we're supposed to be the social worker, the school counselor, the teacher, and make sure they damn well better have really good test scores or we'll really be in trouble.
Yes. And it's standardized testing. And if you don't do well, you lose money, which seems to be reversed, but fine, whatever.
Exactly. We're going to take away your funding and you got to do better now.
Do better. Yeah. No, that's, excuse me. Wait, that's not how that works.
Right. Wow. Cool. So you have a lot going.
Trying.
That is fantastic. So other than mental health, which you have so much going for, do you have other areas that you focus on, or is it strictly mental health?
No. Biggest one, besides mental health, the two issues I hope I'm known for and I'm most passionate about, the other one's education. I am the Allentown School District, which is about 75% of the area I represent, is the fourth largest and third poorest in Pennsylvania. We have the most unequal funding system in the entire country. The gap between the richest and the poorest school districts is unfathomable. And it's also, again, the highest in the country. And Allentown is an area where 90% of the kids live in some level of poverty, which means we have greater needs and fewer resources. And my biggest goal is to try to bring more money home to help give our kids the education that they need. There's a lot more to it than money, certainly, but that's unquestionably the biggest challenge in my legislative district, is trying to do everything I can for the Allentown School District.
Right. I read some really cool stuff that you had written as a legislator, talking about even just pieces of racism, which I know you explained really eloquently. Like, it doesn't make you racist if we have systems that perpetuate these people, you know, who are disadvantaged to always being disadvantaged, then we're living in a racist society and we need to look at the laws and such.
You don't need to be scribbling racial epithets to be maintaining racism. Exactly. I have a school district that's probably 85% or so of the kids are people of color. And the unequal funding system hurts them the hardest. And you can't tell me that we'd be in the same situation if all these kids were white. And I say this as a white man. I mean, it's just, it is reality that this system is in effect, at least in part, because of racism. And nobody will ever be able to convince me otherwise. So as long as we have these systems in place that disproportionately affect minority students and minority children and their families, racism is going to exist.
Yeah.
And my goal as a legislator needs to be to help all of these kids, but especially the kids who have it the hardest, who are all too often children of color.
Yeah. Wow, that is incredible stuff. I know I'm proud to be a part of St. Paul Public Schools, where we have a school board policy that essentially says we understand that we have institutional racism by some of our practices in our school district, and we're going to do what we can to push against that.
That's great.
And change that.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Wow. Cool. Well, man, thank you for all the work you are doing. Two obviously very passionate pieces of my heart as well, the mental health piece and education. So that's phenomenal. So I know you've been kind of weaving some in and out, different suggestions and things, but I'm wondering if you have any final thoughts of tips and advice, suggestions for people who may be going through a really rough patch right now, as far as their mental health?
Do whatever you can to not give in to it. That may mean forcing yourself to go for a walk, to read a book, to play a video game, to start meditating, and recognize you have to do something if you're ever going to get better. Try to seek help if you can. But more than anything else, remember you're not alone. I mean, and I said this in that speech you've been kind enough to reference. There are genuinely thousands, if not millions, of people that would stop their own lives to try to help you get through your rough patch, having never met you. And they love you because you're a person with value and worth, and they want to make you feel better and help you help yourself to feel better, and try to recognize that you're never alone, and seek help if you can.
Ah, fantastic words of advice. All right. Well, man, I can't thank you enough.
Thank you for the work you
do, really, for the work you do, as well as for taking the time to be on the Depression Files. I am going to be following your career now that I know you.
Thank
and
you.
I have to say, for a guy who's writing some sci-fi stuff and, and playing video games and naming kids after video game characters, you're actually a really decent, pretty normal dude.
I hope so.
I am just kidding. No, the work you do is fantastic, and you're an inspiration to all. So thank you again for your time and for your service.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate that. Ditto.
Yeah, well, keep in touch and stay healthy.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Depression Files. Please know that if you are currently suffering from depression and are experiencing thoughts of suicide, please reach out for help. In the United States, you can text to 741741 to connect with a trained crisis counselor, or you can go to suicide.org for a list of international suicide hotlines. If you're a man who has experienced depression and would like to be interviewed for the show, please reach out to me on Twitter at AlLevin18. Thank you again for listening to The Depression Files.